Morning, we're going to talk about Ecclesiastes, and rather than break it up into small pieces and spend a few weeks on it, we're going to try to do it all in one shot this morning. So we'll serve lunch around 12, and we'll be done by 3. We'll actually take a broader, bigger picture approach, and my purpose, my hope in doing this morning is to give you a framework with which to work within. So your homework for the next few months, whatever you want to do, is to, on your own, let the Lord lead you, but read more in detail. And the reason we're doing it this way, or I'm doing it this way, is because Ecclesiastes is a very difficult book to understand. And especially when you take it piece by piece, it's difficult to keep the big picture in front of you. So you may read something like, a living dog is better than a dead lion. And you don't want to necessarily take that word for word as a statement in and of itself, because it might not make a whole lot of sense to you. But in the big picture, it will. And so, again, we're going to kind of do some broader brushstrokes, and we'll get into some specifics as well. But I believe that there's something in it for everybody. It's a book that is a part of the wisdom literature of the Bible. So it's right in there between Proverbs and Song of Solomon and Psalms. And so it's not so much an account of the supernatural works of God as much as it's a discourse on what Solomon, the author, learned over his life, during his lifetime. And Solomon, as we know through Kings and Chronicles and the different references to him, was the son of David. He was the second king of Israel. He was, at the time, and possibly today, the wisest man that we've known. And that wisdom was given to him by God. Beyond that, he also accumulated vast amounts of wealth and vast amounts of stuff. And he built the first temple, the first permanent temple. And so, if we were to ever look at somebody who was, quote, successful in the world standards, it could very well be him. And so it ought to give us, not just because it's in the Bible, I mean, that should be enough, but it should give us a little bit more gravity when we hear his words. If Bill Gates were to come and give you a discourse on finance and how to invest, we'd probably listen to him, right? And so as Solomon has given us these words and these lessons, we need to listen to him because he's been there, he's done that. And so Solomon, throughout Ecclesiastes, if you just read it straight through and read it more casually than in depth, you may come away a little depressed or a little discouraged, because a lot of it is life is meaningless, life is meaningless, wealth is meaningless, wisdom is meaningless. Possessions are meaningless. And you get to some of the ends of these chapters and you just go, wow, is there any hope? And in describing life in this way, he's making a very bold statement. And he's trying to highlight our need. And the undertones, if you read carefully, are what link it to the gospel message, or what drive the point home in our hearts. And so we're going to look at this, and we're going to see how we can interpret and understand it. The reason I'm doing this today is it's the end of the year. It's our last Sunday service before the new year. And I think it's important to look to understand God's ways in this, okay? Because we're going to talk about the seasons of life. We're going to talk about the meaning of life. These are all questions that we've asked ourselves, right? Have we ever caught ourselves wondering why? Why do I bother? Why do I do this? What's the point? Is there ever an end to the Monday through Friday 9 to 5? You know, where does that get me in the end? And Solomon asked these same questions. He was no different than us in that way. And really, we're no different than each other in that at some point in our lives, we stop and we ask, why? What's the point? And so the first key to understanding Ecclesiastes, you may want to write this down for when you study in the future. The first key is that Solomon, in most of Ecclesiastes, and it's clear when you're looking for it, he's describing an under the sun viewpoint. And what that means, he's describing an earthly viewpoint apart from God. And he's not saying that God doesn't exist. He's not saying that God's not involved. But he's saying that if we, what we would, I'm going to put it in our terms now, if what we as non-Christians see as what the world sees without looking through the filter of the Bible and through Christianity, an under the sun viewpoint, this is all there is. And so it's as much of a philosophical or even existential discourse as is anything else. And I think that's really important because where we live, you and I, we think through things a lot. We want things to be logical. We want things to make sense. We want there to be reason. And so Ecclesiastes stands out as a book of reason. And yet it still points to God. How many times have we heard or had people say to us, you know, that doesn't make sense. You're a fool for believing in Christianity. You know, it's all hogwash or whatever. But reality is that for thousands of years, people, philosophers have sought the meaning of life. And it's never been facts. It's always been a question. It's always been a theory. It's always been an A, B, and C, but there's no, you know, it doesn't equal D. And the reason why there's always been the questioning, there's always been these variant viewpoints is because the answer doesn't lie in conventional wisdom. The answer lies in above the sun viewpoint where we engage with spirituality, where we engage with who Christ is. Does that make sense so far? So again, most of Ecclesiastes, he's describing an under the sun viewpoint, a life lived apart from an understanding of who God is. It's interesting to note, again, that this is a book that's different from the others. And I love it because it's really an evangelistic message for us, but for the people of the day, the nations other than Israel. Whenever Solomon references God, he references God not as Yahweh, the personal name of God to the Israelites, but as Elohim, the exalted God, the creator God, the judging God. And so he's saying to the nations, my God, Elohim, is greater than your God. And my God is what gives definition to your under the sun viewpoint. And so he's saying, my God, Yahweh, you would call him Elohim because he trumps everything that you know. And so today let's listen to these words and let's think through what Solomon's saying through that viewpoint where he's trying to make a logical progression to show, to demonstrate our need for Christ. And so that's what gets us to this time of year where we're making decisions for next year, where we're planning ahead. How many of you guys have made New Year's resolutions yet? Or have you, you know, started thinking about them? No? Okay, there's one. How many of you plan on making a resolution or two? Or how many of you done it in the past? I know we all have. And so, but what drives those resolutions? Christmas is coming up. Christmas is the celebration of the advent of Jesus being born. And we're going to see how Ecclesiastes leads right into that. See, Ecclesiastes, again, it shows, it demonstrates our need for a Savior. It shows that our understanding of the greatest wisdom, the greatest wealth, the greatest possession, the greatest accomplishments in life can't give us fulfillment in and of themselves. It can't give us hope in and of itself. And so it points to the need for the coming of Jesus, which now we're on the other side of, and he's come. So there's under the sun and there's above the sun. There's the earthly, the tangible, in our own strength, and then there's in the realm, in the understanding, the framework of who Christ is in the Word of God. We'll see in Ecclesiastes, or you'll see as you read it, that he repeats himself a lot, and it gets monotonous almost. And you know, how many times can you describe how the fact that we all die? and he does it about 20 times. And at some point, it's like, okay, get it. We're going to die. But the device here is that he's repeating it because he wants to drive it home. In the beginning of the text, he says that vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Vanity in this sense, in the Hebrew, it means a vapor. It means something that's absurd or even meaningless. I think the best way to understand it in this context is as a vapor. So it's something that's not easily grasped. It's not something that remains. It's there for but a second, and it's gone. And I think secondarily, we can understand it as meaningless or absurdity. So he's saying a life, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And when there's repetition in the Bible, again, it's to drive it home. They in Hebrew, they didn't have a superlative word. So how we have, you know, Seth is the greatest and the brightest, or the dumbest. Vanity of vanities is saying it's, you know, the greatest vanity of all. And so that's important. So here's a man who's lived life. Here's a man who, not in his own words, but by all accounts, is the wisest that has lived. Kings and queens, including the Queen of Sheba, would travel years just to sit before him and question him and sit under his wisdom. They'd bring gifts. He would accumulate wealth. Every 3 years, ships would come back full of expensive wood and peacocks and exotic animals and everything in between. There was a steady flow of wealth and riches. But here he is, he's saying, he's starting off the book, vanity of vanity, all is vanity. I've seen life, I've seen literally almost everything that's under the sun, I've had everything I could ever want. I've been smarter and known more and been wiser than anybody else. And here I am, I'm telling you, it's all for naught. You see, Koheleth is the name that Solomon uses in this scripture, and it means literally the preacher. And so the preacher in front of an assembly, much like here we are today. And whether it was at first an oral discourse or it was purely written, it was meant as, or as written, developed as much of an autobiography as anything, to pass on what he knew, to make sure that the generations that were to come wouldn't fall into these pitfalls, into these traps. And so he's saying, again, vanity of vanity, all is vanity. How many times we look for meaning in, you know, if I just had a better job, if I just made 10,000 more a year, I'd be fine. If I just had a better car that looked nicer, if I had one more kid, or, you know, if I didn't have to deal with that coworker at work. And we think of these things as keys to enriching our lives. And yet, when those things happen, usually something else is right in line to take its place as a complaint, right? So vanity of vanities, and I'm repeating that on purpose because we need to keep in front of us the finality, the inefficiency of earthly things. We need to constantly be reminded of our need for Christ. And Ecclesiastes 1, verse 13 and 14 says, "And I set my heart," this is Solomon talking, "to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they have been exercised. They may have been exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind." How many times we go after those things that we think will fulfill our need, and we get there, and they're gone. Or again, the pleasure that we find in them is fleeting. See, Solomon sought meaning. He sought the purpose of life. He sought fulfillment through everything under the sun, through wisdom, through pleasure, through accomplishment, and through possessions. Again, people would come to him and seek his wisdom, and there's stories and accounts in the Bible of how he would deal with situations and the wisdom with which he would apply to them. He sought pleasure through having 300 concubines and 700 wives. and I'm not going to go into details. He sought accomplishment, or he sought meaning and accomplishment by building the temple, then building, taking twice as long to build his palace, and then rebuilding cities from coast to coast, if you will. There's only one coast in Israel, but he sought meaning and possessions, again, by acquiring as much as he could, by having people bring him gifts and exotic things. And it says that silver was so common in Jerusalem that it was as if it was another stone and thrown to, you know, is what they made the concrete out of. And so he, the progression of Ecclesiastes takes us through his search of wisdom and how he found it wanting. It takes us through his search for pleasure and how he found it wanting. It takes us through the search for the accomplishment and the possessions and how, in the end, he found them worthless. And in between these discourses, he's inserting things, but the good of man is the gift of God to enjoy that which he has, to enjoy the fruit of his labor. And so he as he's bringing us down, he's still building us up a little bit. And he brings us down again, and he builds us up. And at the end, after we're way down, there's just two verses that tie everything together. And we'll save those for in a minute. Let's go to Ecclesiastes 3. We're going to look at kind of a microcosm of all of this. I'm sure many of you read it before, but hopefully we can read it with new eyes this morning. And what I also love about Ecclesiastes is the poetic nature, is the flow, is the beauty in it, in the midst of him talking about death about every other verse. So Ecclesiastes 3, starting in verse 1, we're just going to read through to verse 14. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to gain and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? So again, what is the point of all our hard work, of our toil, of our struggle? Verse 10, I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing can be taken away from it. God does it that men should fear before him. And so, again, over the course of Ecclesiastes, Solomon is bringing us down. He's showing us the meaninglessness of life, the cyclical nature, the never-ending, you know, there's daylight, and then there's moonlight, there's daylight, there's moonlight. The rivers get swept into the ocean, then it rains, and they get filled back up, and there's all these cycles that never end. They last longer than we do, even though we've been put as God's keepers on earth in charge of nature, yet they cycle with or without us, whether we're alive or we're dead. And there's a times and there's seasons for everything. And no matter how much we worry or what we do, there's a sense in which it's out of our control. And so he's saying all these things to point again to the fact that we can't control nature. We can't control the circumstances of life. We can't control what people do to us. And he says, I've seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He's made everything beautiful in his time. So again, he's inserting a little piece here to build us up, and he's saying that it's all in God's timing, and in God's timing, the finished work is beautiful. And how many times have we seen that in our lives, where we've had to wait, or we've been anxious, or we've been worried, and we give it over to God, and honestly, sometimes we may even forget about it. But then when that peace is fulfilled, it's perfect. Think of Abraham and Isaac. Think of Jacob and his wife. Think of the promises of Israel and going through the wilderness into the promised land and how beautiful and how abundant it was described to us in the Bible. For me, it's been a job, waiting 6 months for a job and giving up hope and then coming back to the Lord and saying, I feel like that's God, got it, that's where you want me. I'm going to not worry, I'm not going to strive, I'm going to give it over to you. And then a week later, I get the call, hey, we want you. You see, God's timing, God knows the beginning from the end. Just last night, I was worrying and I was getting frustrated because, you know, I'm in a situation I can't control. And my prayer in my head before I spoke it was, you know, God, can you speed it up? You know, can you just accelerate things? And before I got to my mouth, I had to laugh out loud because I thought, wow, you know, what am I talking about tomorrow? Okay, God, rather than you speeding it up, how about you give me the patience to learn the lessons that you're trying to teach me? There's a time for everything. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he's put eternity in their hearts. I love that idea. It's one that Paul talks about. It's one that Jesus talks about. He sets something inside of us that responds to that which is lasting. And so again, he's describing our understanding and our striving under the sun apart from God. Yeah, he's saying that there's an element in each and every one of us, our spirit, that yearns, that craves to know God, because that is what is eternal. He's put eternity in our hearts, that longing to understand the meaning of life even is a God-given hunger that drives us to him, if we're honest. And here we have the famous or infamous refrain, basically, eat, drink, and be merry. And it actually says that word verbatim later in Ecclesiastes. And it's something we probably all thought just, you know, existed in the pub, right? But it's actually from the Bible. Eat, drink, and be merry. So again, under the sun, we strive, we toil, we labor, and oftentimes we don't have a lot to show for it. Or even if we do gain, and we do gain wealth, and we find that we've got lots of toys and 3 cars and a nice house, we still find ourselves unsatisfied. And so he's saying that under the sun, you can't really find the meaning, that you can only enjoy it for a short season. But with God, God's gift to you is the ability to enjoy the fruit of your labor, whether it be an old clunker car or whether it be a nice car, that God will enable you to enjoy that which he's given you. So my old clunker car feels like a Rolls Royce sometimes because it gets me from point A to B, and I know it's what God gave me, and I don't have to pay for it. It's, you know, already paid for. I didn't steal it, don't worry. So the gift of God to us as Christians is the ability to enjoy the fruits of our labor. How many of us know somebody who's not saved and they're always striving? If I could only get that promotion. Yes, I've got 3 cars, but I really want that 4th one. Yes, I've got a great house, but I really want to live up on the hill. Or live in Tiburon. And again, if we're honest with ourselves, right now some of you are saying, well, that's not me. Or I don't really know anyone. They're actually kind of happy. They seem happier than I do. But if they're honest with themselves, if we're honest with ourselves, I'm pretty sure we can pretty quickly find the emptiness in all those things. But when you're living above the sun, with the above the sun viewpoint, under the framework of who Christ is, our labor, instead of being for us, instead of being for our pleasure, becomes a labor for God, a labor for him, for his pleasure. And when we're obedient, as we'll see, when we're obedient, there's always joy in our obedience to Christ. And so that labor that we take on, whether it be the mundane or whether it be something grand, as long as it's for Christ, there will be joy in it. And there will be satisfaction, because our meaning for life isn't found in labor, isn't found in possession, isn't found in toys or accolades. But as this verse says, and as Ecclesiastes in chapter 12 finishes, let's go there actually. So again, Solomon's breaking us down to show the very absurdity of our struggle, of our earthly struggle apart from Christ. And he spent about 9 chapters doing this. And in the end, he says in chapter 12, verse 8, vanity of vanity. So he's bringing us around to the beginning. Again, it's an amazing piece of literature where he's stating at the beginning, he's bracketing the book with this term, vanity of vanities. And in between, he's showing us, demonstrating what he means by that. But then he gives us the conclusion. He gives us the thesis of it all. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright, words of truth. So he spent time to sort everything out, to think about his life, think about what he learned, and the pieces to pass it on, that he wanted to pass on, and how he wanted to present it. And this is the result of that work. Picking up in verse 11, the words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. And who is the shepherd? So again, he's linking it back to the narrative of God's covenant with his people. And he's setting us up for the coming of his son, the coming of God's son. And he's saying that, you know, the words of the wise are like goads. They keep us on the right path. And they may poke or prod or hurt our feelings or hurt our pride, more likely our pride. But they keep us on the straight and narrow. And they're like nails, well-driven nails, so they firm up our foundation. They firm up our position. They firm up our understanding of who God is. And so he's saying, take heed to these things. Verse 12, and further, my son, be admonished by these. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Here it is. Fear God and keep his commandments. That's it. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. And so as Christians, many of us already know this, but again, it needs to be reminded. We're here to worship God. That word, fear God, is better understood as putting God at the center of our lives, having a healthy respect for God and a healthy understanding of who he is and who we are. So fear God. Put him in the right position in our lives. Put him at the center. Put him in a place of esteem and worship. How many of us do that every day? How many of us stray away from that? And we struggle and we strive and we look at earthly things, and yet there's the key. We find ourselves dissatisfied in life, and yet we are supposed to find satisfaction in him, in our understanding of who God is. Fear God and keep his commandments, obedience. So again, when the toil of our life moves away from an under-the-sun viewpoint where the toil of our life is the mundane. I go to work to earn a living, to keep an apartment or a house, and to buy a car. Versus keeping God's commandments and obeying God's commandments, doing everything unto him, serving others, loving others. The spiritual benefit, the spiritual fulfillment that we get is that which we've been longing for. So when we fear God, when we have a correct understanding of who he is, and under that umbrella, under that understanding, we obey him and keep his commandments, we find that peace that the world is looking for. And so if you have a friend that says, you know, I just can't get there, it doesn't make sense. Or if somebody tells you, you're a fool for believing that stuff, that made-up stuff, it doesn't make sense. you know, a good question to ask them is, what's the point of your life then? You're going to die. And when you die, you're not taking your house, you're not taking your car, you're not taking your toys. When you die, you have no control over who gets that stuff. You can leave something in your will, but who's to say that your child or your heir is going to treat it wisely and with care? There's a sense of fate in Solomon's words, because there is no control beyond your response to God. And so when things are spinning out of control and the scenes of our life are changing left and right, and we can't keep up and we're afraid and we're not sure what the next step is, we need to realize that it is in God's control. And so we need to look at those situations through his eyes. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. In the end, God will judge the evil and the righteous. He'll judge the secret thing. And that's something that's supremely comforting to us as Christians. And if it's not, we need to examine our lives. We want to shy away from that J word. We don't like that judgment word. It's been thrown around and misused and miscast, including by us. But we need to embrace it, because what it means is that, you know, that great equalizer, death, and again, Solomon gets into this in depth, you know, death comes to us all. It comes to the rich, it comes to the poor, it comes to the wise, it comes to the unwise, to the fool. It comes to the animals, and it comes to the humans. It's a great equalizer. There's no way around it. It comes. And so will we store up things that don't go with us, things that are left behind, or will we build up earthly treasures in heaven? I love what Paul says, that he is faithful to complete that which he started in us. The times of our life, the things that seem to not have an expiration date and it's just dragging on, we need to give over to the Lord, because he's faithful to complete those things. He's faithful to complete the work that he started in us. 2,000 years ago, a baby was born in a manger in obscurity, without the trappings of royalty, without a court full of admirers, without royal garb and a crown. But that baby born in a manger, the incarnation of Jesus Christ, was the fulfillment of God's promise to his people. It was the hope and the expectation of generations past. It was the key. It was the bookend of Solomon's wandering and wondering, Solomon's quest to find meaning. I love how Solomon leaves us in this passage in Ecclesiastes, because he gives us hints along the way. He says, you know, it's the gift of God to enjoy the fruit of your labor. And instead of giving another 3-chapter discourse, he just says, the point of it all, the conclusion of it all, is to fear God and obey him. To leave the judgment for God, because he'll judge the righteous and the wicked. He'll judge from the beginning and the end. He'll judge the secret thing. So we don't need to worry about an injustice that happens to us. We need to stand up for the oppressed out of love and out of godliness, but we leave the judgment to God. And so the freeing part of God's judgment is that we've been saved by Christ, by that advent, by the narrative of Jesus dying on the cross and rising again. Death has no sting when we're under the blood, under that covering of Jesus Christ. And so as we celebrate the advent of Christ, we can celebrate the fact that we're covered, that we don't have to live with an earthly viewpoint, an under-the-sun viewpoint, but we can live with an above-the-sun viewpoint. There was a time in my life that was a struggle about 10 years ago, and you know, it just felt like you're in this black hole and there's not a whole lot of ways out. There's no way out. And I remember just crying out to God, you know, God, I just get me through this. I don't care what I look like on the other side. I don't care what I have left on the other side. I just need to know there's an end. And I talked to one of my pastor friends, and he told me this story. He said, you know, I used to fly. My dad used to fly in as a crop duster and, you know, just fly in general. And we would take off in the worst storms. It'd be raining and windy. It looked like you would die as soon as you got in the air, or maybe you wouldn't even make it in the air. And he says, we would take off, and we would fly straight up, as you know, as big of an incline as we can get. Because as soon as we would get above the storm, the turbulence would be gone, the rain, we'd be above the rain, we'd be above the wind. You see, we find ourselves struggling and striving so often when God's saying, rise above, take on my viewpoint, take on my perspective. Get out of your earthly understanding. See the world, see your circumstance, see your struggle with the eyes that I do. And so when we turn our eyes upward, when we rise above the situation, when we take on God's view, we can fly above it. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word this morning. Thank you for what you're doing in our lives. God, I ask again that you'd give us understanding. Lord, there's a lot to take out of this. There's a lot of bits and pieces that may not have been ordered the best, but Father, I ask that you'd speak, you'd minister. God, that there'd be something that we can hold on to, that we can learn. Jesus, I pray that during this time that you would minister to our hearts, you'd daily remind us of the sending of your Son to give us that meaning that we long for, to give us that hope we crave. God, to fulfill the part of us that is eternal and longs for the eternal, that which lasts. Father, help us to rise above and to get our eyes off the earthly things, the things that don't hold meaning, that don't hold satisfaction. Father, today as a church, we turn our eyes to you. Lord, we want to fear you. We want to hold you in high esteem in the center of our lives. God, we want to obey your commandments step by step, day by day. In Jesus' name,